I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hey, guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, and welcome back. Or if you're new here, hi, welcome, I'm Georgia. And I was going to introduce this episode as one in my history series, but actually, as I'm saying this, I think this potentially falls better under the umbrella of true crime. Although nobody was physically hurt in this scandal, it was undeniably a massive crime that spent years in and out of court. This was a massive case here in the UK, and it reached over the pond to the USA as well, with the effects of it still being felt today. In fact, new information was still coming out about this on the day I was writing this script, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot more going forward. Yes, we're going to be talking about the News of the World hacking scandal, something which is still rocking Britain to this very day. But first, let's begin with a brief history of the News of the World newspaper, first published in 1843 by John Brown Bell. At this time, it was the cheapest newspaper around, priced at just 3 pence, and was aimed directly at the working classes, who were fairly newly literate thanks to an increase in access to education. Even back in the 19th century, this paper was known for shock and scandal and criminal news. As one article I read described it, it was a purveyor of titillation, which is just a fantastic phrase. The paper would cover trials and prosecutions in depth, transcripts of police descriptions of brothels, streetwalkers and immoral women. It remained known for this style of reporting all the way until its closure in 2011. In 1969, Rupert Murdoch bought the paper, which was his first foothold in British media. He already owned a number of papers in Australia and New Zealand, and then soon after this, he also procured The Sun. In 1984, the paper became reorganised under the umbrella of News International and was transformed from a broadsheet into a tabloid, becoming the Sunday sister paper of The Sun. From there, it focused almost solely on celebrity scandal, gossip, populist news, and thanks to its focus on sex scandals, the paper became colloquially known as the Screws of the World. Safe to say, the paper wasn't exactly hard-hitting journalism. It was the 20th, 21st century equivalent of a scandal sheet. It was sensationalist. Safe to say, celebrities hated this paper, but there was little they could do to stop the articles going out, and as the years went on, the journalists at the News of the World became more and more arrogant, feeling entitled to the stories with little care for the repercussions. And that's kind of always been this age-old question. Is this what celebrities sign up for when they put themselves in the spotlight? I don't think so personally, but it's something people do have very strong opinions about. In the year 2000, a woman called Rebecca Brooks became the editor of the News of the World aged just 32. She was the nation's youngest national newspaper editor, and she was known to be Murdoch's right-hand man when it came to the British media. She joined the News of the World as a researcher aged just 21, and she managed to work her way up the ranks. In 2003, she then became editor of The Sun, and Andy Coulson took over her position at the News of the World. This is an important tidbit to remember for later, but Rebecca Brooks essentially became Andy Coulson's boss, and it was later uncovered that the two had been having a years-long affair. Although the pages of the News of the World were full of celebrity scandal, the paper itself managed to avoid scandals for many, many years, at least until 2005, when the paper's royal editor, Clive Goodman, wrote a short article about Prince William hurting his knee. According to the BBC, the article he wrote about is how William had pulled a tendon in his knee after a kid's kickabout with Charlton Athletic. He then saw Prince Charles's personal doctor and was now having physiotherapy at Cirencester Hospital. It was all rather inconspicuous, nothing particularly damning in there, but it was strange when Prince William heard about it because no one should have known about his injury. Then, a week later, the paper published another story about how William had borrowed broadcasting equipment from the ITM political editor, Tom Bradby. But weirdly, the article appeared before the pair had even met to make the exchange of this equipment. The meeting had been organised, but only 4 people knew about it. How could the paper have this information? According to CBS News, Bradby and William were talking about this, and Bradby said that when he had chats with tabloid journalists, phone hacking was quite an open secret. It was very rife. Maybe that's what was happening. Understandably, William was upset because that was the only explanation here, and so he turned this information over to his secretary, who in turn contacted the police. 6 months later, Goodman was arrested along with a private investigator that he'd hired for much of the work, Glenn Mulcair, and that's a name you're going to be hearing a lot in this episode. Glenn Mulcair, on the request of Clive Goodman, had been hacking Prince William's voicemails. Mulcair's office was raided by the police, in which they found thousands of pages of notes relating to hackings. There were whiteboards with information spelled out on them, and even more. There was evidence of him teaching other people how to hack. But this didn't seem to bother the Met police. They at least weren't bothered enough to look through all the notes at this time in 2006. Or maybe they did look through the notes and they just decided it was a later problem. Because boy oh boy, would it become a later problem. Years later, it would come out that Mulcair had even found details of people in the witness protection scheme, which gives vulnerable witnesses a completely new identity and a fresh start. I mean, that information in the hands of journalists is potentially putting people's lives at risk. Mulcair had found the fresh identities of Mary Bell and Robert Thompson, infamous names here in the UK for their crimes, and some may argue that they don't deserve to be under witness protection to be given new names and identities, but they served their time, they had these new identities. Did they deserve to live in peace? That's up to you. Luckily, this information was never published, but Mulcair had it. But this would all be a later problem because at this time in 2006, nobody really seemed to care about it. The police certainly didn't really investigate it. On November 9th, 2006, both Goodman and Mulcair pled guilty to conspiracy to intercept communications without lawful authority under the Criminal Law Act 1977. According to Chris Trihorn for The Guardian, the charges were actually related to 3 members of the royal household, but the investigation found that other targets may have been David Blunkett, the Home Secretary, Government Minister David Miliband, footballer Sol Campbell, and Rebecca Brooks herself. Upon pleading guilty, Goodman apologised to the 3 members of the royal household who were concerned who had been hacked, so Prince William, Prince Harry and Prince Charles. The News of the World's editor at the time, Andy Coulson, said that the paper would make a substantial donation to charities of the Prince's choice to make up for what had happened. It was found that Goodman and Mulcair had made 609 calls to their phone numbers to listen to their voicemail messages, with Goodman saying he felt he had to break the law because of pressures from the paper for breaking stories. Every day they needed breaking stories. In January 2007, Goodman was sentenced to 4 months in jail, whilst Mulcair was sentenced to 6 months. Editor Andy Coulson said that he was unaware that this hacking was taking place, but shortly after the guilty verdict, he did resign. Not that he exactly found himself in trouble financially after this point though, because he actually ended up just getting hired as the Director of Communications for the Conservative Party leader at the time, David Cameron. And David Cameron would later go on to become Prime Minister. It reminds me of a joke in Brooklyn Nine-Nine when I think the commissioner gets fired and he just ends up going and getting a higher paid job in the private sector. It just happens. Throughout all of this, News International, so News of the World's parent company, insisted that this was just the work of one rogue reporter. And despite an investigation by the Met Police, London's police, they said there was no evidence that the phone hacking went any further than the royals. It was very contained, apparently. The agency in charge of investigating this at the time was the Counter-Terrorism Department at the Met, and part of their role within the police was having very close relationships with the media for obvious reasons. But with a close professional relationship comes a close personal relationship. How much did they choose to ignore, to brush under the carpet, to preserve these relationships? Because the people involved in the hacking scandal were all their friends. If it came out, it was going to look very, very bad for them. The Crown Prosecution Service have said that if they were made aware of the extent of the notes, the extent of the evidence this time, they would have conducted a further investigation. But they weren't made aware. I suppose this is a good time to lay out what this phone hacking actually consisted of. How journalists were able to hack in and listen to people's voicemail inboxes without the person ever knowing. How journalists were able to access people's voicemails back in the early noughties. So remember, this was the early noughties, the tech, the systems were very different to they are now, and they were a lot more easily hacked. And the technique that journalists used was likely a very simple one, because the only information you'd actually have to know was an individual's phone number, which for a PI was going to be pretty easy information to get a hold of. All they would have to do is ring the phone number and hope that whoever the number belonged to didn't pick up the phone, so it went to voicemail. Once it did, all you'd have to do was enter the individual's PIN number to access the inbox. Every single person had a PIN number to access their voicemail. However, the vast majority of people would never bother changing their PIN number from the default, which was usually 0000 or 1234. In this time, the early noughties, cybersecurity wasn't really something that was drilled into people, mobile phones were relatively new, and a lot of people wouldn't have been technologically literate, to even know if there was something that you needed to do to protect your safety. If someone did change their PIN, they more often than not use a very easily guessed number, like their own birthday or the birthday of a loved one, another thing very easy for a PI to find. Remember, this was a time before smartphones, before QWERTY keyboards on your phones. When to send a text message, you relied on multi-tap pressing the same number button multiple times until you reached the desired letter, and so on. Or from the late 90s, T9 predictive text became more common, but still it took a while to text and you were limited by character limits, hence why text talk in this time was so common, using 4 instead of writing 4, using 2 instead of writing 2. A lot of you in my age range and older are probably rolling your eyes at this explanation, but 32% of my audience are in the younger age bracket, so this is for you guys. You never had to live through the pain of trying to text. All of this is to say that people used to utilise voicemail a lot more than they do nowadays. If you had a message to share and people weren't answering their phone, you'd leave a voicemail, whereas nowadays you'd probably just send them a quick text. And that meant that often very juicy details could be found in voicemail inboxes. It's the same as somebody hacking your iMessages now, instead it was just voicemails. So the Royal Hacking came out in 2005 and Mulcair and Coulson were convicted in 2007. But as you can probably guess, this was far from the end of the story, because just 2 years later, it emerged that News International had agreed a number of confidential out-of-court settlements which prevented more hacking allegations being aired publicly. Again, the Met Police knew this at the time, they'd seized all the aforementioned notes and documents, they just decided not to pursue it. In mid-2009, The Guardian reports on more alleged hacking incidents at the News of the World, saying that more than £1 million had been paid to settle legal actions that threatened to expose the hacking, and they alleged that thousands of people had had their voicemails hacked, including cabinet ministers. The Guardian wrote at the time, the Metropolitan Police took the decision not to inform all the individuals whose phones had been targeted, and the Crown Prosecution Service decided not to take News Group executives to court. All of this causing the Press Complaints Commission to launch a new report to determine whether or not there had been new breaches of privacy by journalists using third parties or unlawful methods, to see if they'd been misled in their previous 2007 investigation where they'd found nothing else was wrong. In November 2009, the Press Complaints Commission released their report saying, despite the manner in which the Guardian's allegations were treated in some quarters, as if they related to current or recent activity, there is no evidence that the practice of phone message tapping is ongoing. The Commission is satisfied that, as far as it is possible to tell, its work aimed at improving the integrity of undercover journalism has played its part in raising standards in this area. They said that no stone had been left unturned, that there was no evidence that anyone other than Goodman or Mulcair had taken part in the hacking, or that the News of the World executives knew of their activities. And as well as this, when the Guardian's articles were published in 2009, the Met Police Commissioner took another look into whether the hacking case should be reopened. But again, it was quickly determined there was no fresh material that could lead to further convictions. Once again, Mulcair's thousands of pages of notes from the 2006 raid were not examined. Assistant Commissioner John Yates said at the time, "There remain now insufficient grounds or evidence to arrest or interview anyone else, and no additional evidence has come to light." But the evidence was right there. It was literally right there. He continued to insist that only a dozen people were affected by the hacking. But then, in 2010, a former News of the World journalist called Sean Hoare came forward to both the New York Times and BBC's Panorama, saying that phone hacking was a very common practice whilst he worked there. And not only that, it was encouraged by the editor, Andy Coulson. And then, on the 15th of December 2010, The Guardian reported that some of the documents seized from Mulcair in 2006 implied that he had been specifically instructed by deputy editor Ian Edmondson to hack the voice messages of celebrities Sienna Miller, Jude Law, and many others. So this is another person apparently aware of what was going on, along with more evidence implicating the chief reporter Neville Thelbeck and assistant director Greg Miskew. Within weeks of this coming out, Andy Coulson then resigned as chief press secretary to David Cameron. It wasn't looking good for him. Are we all keeping up here? I'm trying to go chronologically, but I know there's a lot of names, a lot of dates. I'm trying to keep it as simple as I can. There was just a lot of people at the News of the World getting implicated after many people insisted that this was an isolated incident to one journalist and one PI. It's becoming clear that it wasn't. It wasn't until January 2011 that the Met Police announced they were finally beginning a new investigation into the phone hacking, following what they called significant new information that they had received. The investigation was called Operation Weeting. And from there, it all comes out. 4 days later, former MP George Galloway claims that the News of the World offered him substantial sums of money after his phone was hacked. On the 9th of February, the Met Police announced a statement saying they've identified more potential victims of hacking whilst reviewing files relating back to the original Goodman and Mulcair case. Yes, that's right, they finally looked through all the notes that Mulcair had made. They said they were urgently notifying people who had previously been told that they weren't involved. We know Mulcair kept detailed notes of his work, his hacking. We know he'd write the name of the victim on the page. We also now know that he'd write the name of the journalist who commissioned him in the top left-hand corner. On some pages they found "For Ian," referring to "For Ian Edmondson." Some said for Clive Goodman, and so on. It was blatantly obvious that more people at the News of the World were involved. On the 18th of February 2011, a judge ruled that Mulcair must now provide information about whether other journalists were involved in the hacking. Legally, he had to share this information if he had it. And then, on the 5th of April 2011, the arrests begin. Neville Thelbeck and Ian Edmondson are both arrested on suspicion of unlawfully intercepting voicemail messages. 3 days later, News International, News of the World sort of umbrella company, starts approaching some of the many, many people suing the paper for the phone hacking, offering apologies and admissions of liability. They said they were going to set up a compensation scheme. On the 10th, they published an apology on their website and on page 2 of the newspaper, not page 1, page 2, apologising for intercepting voicemails between 2004 and 2006. And they say it's a past behaviour that's a matter of genuine regret. As we'll come to find out, the hacking had been happening for many years prior to 2004. Some people refused to accept the compensation and the apology, with Sienna Miller actually going to court instead to win a case to access her phone records to see if her phone had been hacked, saying in November 2022 that being a victim of the hacking led her to have an absolute breakdown on every single level. I mean, just imagine your privacy being violated in such a way you'd never trust anyone again. Sienna said she spent years convinced friends or family were leaking intimate details about her to the press. She cut people off, she was scared of everyone around her. Turns out it was just the News of the World listening to her voicemail. It would eventually be ascertained that there were 4,744 victims of the hacking, and the list of celebrities just goes on and on and on. But also, this was normal people as well, people who found themselves in the news for whatever reason. The News of the World really didn't discriminate as to whose phones they hacked. It was actually probably easier to do it to normal people than to celebrities. But just to list some of the celebrities, some of the public figures who had their phones hacked in this time. There is Andy Coulson. So Andy Coulson himself had his phone hacked. Boris Johnson, Chris Tarrant, the presenter of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, Elle Macpherson, George Galloway, MP, Heather Mills, wife of Paul McCartney. I'm sure Paul McCartney is probably on this list as well. Paul Gascoigne, Prince Harry, Prince William, Prince Charles, we already know that. Rebecca Brooks herself had her phone hacked. Steve Coogan, Ulrika Johnson, Wayne Rooney. The list just goes on and on. Over the next few months, the investigation continues. In May, a number of people who had been hacked, including an ex-Scotland Yard commander, won a High Court bid for judicial review into the police inquiry, believing that their human rights had been breached. More information just keeps coming out over the coming months, each new thing worse than the last. More journalists are arrested or people connected with the case are arrested. And then, on the 4th of July 2011, The Guardian reported that Millie Dowler's phone had been hacked in the days after she went missing. Now, I literally just uploaded an episode about Millie's case in anticipation of this video going live, so I would highly recommend you go and watch that if you want to really understand the full depravity of what News of the World did to her and to her family. But a very brief synopsis. Millie Dowler was 13 years old when she went missing in 2002 on her way home from school. In 2011, serial killer Levi Belfield would finally be convicted of her murder, him having abducted and tortured her before he ended her life. Millie's case was huge here in the UK, with her name and face featured on every front page of every news programme, every newspaper, including the News of the World. In the days after Millie disappeared, her friends and family would obviously call her phone and leave messages for her, begging for her to get in contact. The News of the World hacked into Millie's phone and listened to her messages, and when her mailbox got full, it's alleged that they deleted messages to make room for more. This made her friends and family think that she was still alive somewhere, just deleting her own messages. It gave them hope, something that Bob and Sally Dowler, Millie's parents, said in an exclusive interview with the News of the World. It also affected the police investigation into her death for obvious reasons. And it wasn't just Millie's phone either, Bob and Sally's phones were both intercepted as well. They would later say that one day they decided to retrace Millie's last steps, it was kind of a pilgrimage for them, and they were baffled when they turned up and there were journalists there ready to snap their photo. This was supposed to be a private moment of grief and it was intruded upon by the press. They were baffled as to how the papers seemed to know exactly where they were going to be at any given time. And they were just normal people who had found themselves in the worst situation imaginable, searching for their lost daughter. They didn't know how to handle this, they just knew that if they wanted to find Millie, then they had to keep her name out there in the press. In the days after Millie's death, a recruitment agency in Telford in Shropshire called Millie's number and left a message for somebody called Nana about a potential job. Now, Telford is nowhere near Walton-on-Thames where Millie had gone missing, and neither was Millie called Nana. It was quite clearly a wrong number situation. But the News of the World journalists heard about this and became convinced that Millie was alive up in Telford looking for a job. Now, the right thing to do would have been for them to contact the authorities or the family to let them know, but the story was more important, so they didn't. They decided to investigate this further on their own. They sent six reporters to Telford to this very small recruitment agency, and on Friday the 12th of April 2002, an employee took a call from a woman who was asking her if her daughter was working for the agency, telling her that her daughter's name was Amanda Dowler, which was Millie's full name, and she asked if she knew of her. The staff checked the records, not thinking anything of it, and they couldn't find anyone by that name. But that wasn't enough though, the woman called back again and said, "I'm her mother and I want to know where she's living and working." But still, the agency didn't have anyone by the name of Amanda Dowler on their records. On Saturday the 13th of April, Valerie Hancock, who ran the business with her son Mark, said a male reporter from the News of the World turned up at her house. She asked the reporter to leave, but he refused, just sitting in his car outside the front. Then Mark received a call from a man who said that he was an editor at the News of the World, saying that he had reason to believe that Millie Dowler was working for their employment agency. Now bear in mind that Millie was 13 at this time. It wasn't legal for her to be working, even if she had run away, and she did look 13 as well. She wouldn't have been able to lie about this. By this point, I'm sure the agency knew the name Millie Dowler. They probably made the connection between Amanda and Millie, and they knew that she was a missing person. Everyone in the country knew the name Millie Dowler, and it was bizarre for them. Hancock's has said on Panorama that the reporters tried to flat out ruin their business. One of the reporters actually approached the manager of their biggest client on a golf course and told him that the agency was recruiting underage girls. As you can imagine, the manager was not amused and it put their contract with this agency in jeopardy. It was a hugely stressful time for this small family-run business, all over a wrong number. It was only after this point, after finding nothing up in Telford, that the News of the World went to Surrey Police with the voicemail. Not so much because they wanted to help the investigation, but because they still wanted their story. Obviously, in order to tell police what they knew, they had to say how they got this information, but Surrey Police didn't really do anything about it. I suppose they had other things to focus on at the time, find Millie. Now, for full clarity, from an article I found on the Register, it does seem there may have been evidence found to suggest that the News of the World weren't deleting the voicemails themselves, but instead they automatically deleted after 72 hours. But I couldn't find that confirmed in many places, so honestly, I don't know what the deal is there. But even if they weren't deleting the messages, hacking into a dead girl's phone for your newest sensationalist story is horrendous enough. And Millie Dowler wasn't the only murder victim to also fall victim to this. Sarah Payne, the mother of Sarah Payne, was hacked, and she had an incredibly close relationship with the paper. She ran child safety campaigns with them for years. The families of Jessica Chapman and Holly Wells were hacked, two 10-year-old girls who were abducted and murdered in August 2002. The family of Madeleine McCann, and that was as late as 2007. There were the families of UK soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, potentially family members of 9/11 victims. There were no words for how depraved, how lacking in empathy this was for the newspaper to do. The story for them came above all else, came above their humanity. When the news about the Dowlers came out, that was kind of it for the paper. There was going to be no coming back from that. The whole country felt personally connected to Millie and to the Dowlers. We'd been there with them through it all. Rupert Murdoch personally released a statement calling the actions deplorable and unacceptable, and he promised full cooperation with the authorities, with the next day his son James Murdoch announcing that he was closing down the paper for good. On the 10th of July 2011, the 8,674th edition would be its last. Around this time as well, the Independent Police Complaints Commission say they're going to take over the investigation into claims that the Met Police were paid off by the News of the World, hence why very little investigation took place all those years earlier. It just kept getting worse. On the 8th of July 2011, Andy Coulson, who was editor at the time of the scandal, was arrested, and so was Clive Goodman once again. Just over a week later, Rebecca Brooks, who had now resigned as the chief executive of News International, was also arrested. She was arrested on charges of suspicion of corruption and conspiring to intercept communications, and she was released on bail after questioning. The Met Police Commissioner, Paul Stevenson, also resigned after revelations the former News of the World executive editor later became communications consultant for the police. All of this was so interconnected. Assistant Police Commissioner John Yates, who'd ruled just 2 years previously that there was no reason to pursue an investigation into the hacking, also resigned. Theresa May, who was Home Secretary at the time, said that the Met Police was going to be investigated for corruption. In the space of about 2 weeks, literally everything crumbled. On the 14th of November 2011, the Leveson Inquiry into Journalistic Ethics opened up in London, where it was very quickly revealed that more than 24 News International employees used the services of the convicted hacker, Glenn Mulcair. 51 politicians, sportsmen, celebrities, and members of the public who had fallen victim to the hacking were granted core participation status in the inquiry, but through the course of the inquiry, 337 witnesses were called in total. In April 2011, James Murdoch says he knew little about the scale of the phone hacking and said he had no reason to look into illegal eavesdropping by his employees. Rupert Murdoch admits there had been a cover-up and apologised for not paying more attention to the scandal many years earlier. The 2000-page report was published in November 2012 with Leveson, I should have looked that up before filming this, found that the Press Complaints Commission was not sufficient, and instead he recommended a new independent body, which would have a wide range of sanctions available to it to basically curtail the press. He also made recommendations regarding the Data Protection Act and about conduct of relations between the press, the police, and politicians. All in all, it's pretty hard to hold people accountable when the people supposed to be doing the accounting are friends with those doing the wrong. After the publication of the report, David Cameron, the Tory party leader, made a statement to the House of Commons where he welcomed many of the findings but expressed serious concerns and misgivings regarding actually implementing the changes. Ed Miliband, the Labour leader at the time, called for full implementation of the report. Nick Clegg, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, was unable to agree with coalition partner Cameron, and so he released his own statement saying that some of the changes were necessary, which I think just perfectly encapsulates the fuckery of British politics with those three parties. Back to early 2012, more things are going on outside of the Leveson inquiry. In February, the News of the World publisher pays out hundreds of thousands to settle lawsuits, and in March, more arrests come. Six people, including Rebecca Brooks, are all arrested on suspicion to pervert the course of justice. Rebecca Brooks, if you recall, was the editor of the News of the World before she moved over to The Sun and the job was handed over to Andy Coulson. It would later come out that Brooks and Coulson were having a six-year-long affair at the peak of the hackings, with the idea basically being that they were in an intimate relationship. He must have shared with her the details of what was going on. In May 2012, Brooks and her husband Charlie Brooks are charged with conspiracy to pervert the course of justice, along with five others. They deny all the charges against them. It was also announced later that year that Brooks was also being charged with conspiracy over alleged illegal payments to a Ministry of Defence employee. Their trials would begin in October 2013 at the Old Bailey in London, and what came out of trial was quite shocking. It had already been revealed at this point that Glenn Mulcair had been paid £100,000 a year to hack phones, although Brooks denied knowing that fact. She said that each individual department had autonomy over their own budgets. She said it was quite normal to have private detectives working with the paper, mainly helping trace people who were difficult to find, so the fact that he was there wasn't a red flag in itself. But journalists generally are very protective of their sources, and it also wouldn't be expected that she would know where their information came from for their stories. Panorama says that Mulcair was using the voicemail trick as early as 1997-98, during the time that Brooks would have been editor at the News of the World. Evidence in the form of emails found that Mulcair was so overwhelmed with hacking requests from the News of the World that he emailed them at one point with the subject line overload, the message simply reading, "No more please." He was contracted with the newspaper for 5 years and was tasked with hacking requests at least once every day for the entire period he was there. That's a whole lot of hacking. In fact, it would turn out there wasn't one major news story from this time in the News of the World that hadn't had input from some kind of hacking. The whole of Rebecca Brooks' trial was basically over whether or not she knew about this during her time as editor, or whether it really was kept from her. However, in the case of Andy Coulson, the evidence did not reflect that he didn't know. In fact, it was very clear that Andy Coulson did know. The case against Brooks relied on circumstantial evidence, but unfortunately for Coulson, the evidence against him was quite concrete. Two former News of the World journalists called Dan Evans and Clive Goodman testified in court that they discussed intercepting voicemails with him. During the time Coulson was editor from 2003 to 2006, over 5,000 people had their voicemails illegally listened to. Goodman called it industrial-scale hacking. After a 7-month-long trial in June 2014, Brooks was found not guilty on all charges presented to her and she was allowed to walk away free. Her husband Charlie was also found not guilty. Andy Coulson, however, was sentenced to 18 months in prison. Former chief reporter Neville Thelbeck and news editor Greg Miskew were given 6 months each, with former reporter James Weatherup also given a 4-month suspended sentence and Glenn Mulcair himself a 6-month suspended sentence. So finally, almost a decade after the original allegations were made, maybe even two decades after the practice of hacking began, there was some kind of justice for those affected, some kind of accountability. And I do think this brings up a wider problem in regards to British tabloids, which really are just gutter journalism. I mean, if you think things got better in the aftermath of this scandal, you would be sorely mistaken. To this day, the British tabloid press remain notoriously aggressive. Are journalists still breaking laws to get their stories? We don't know. We hope they're not phone hacking. I mean, it's much more difficult to phone hack now in the era of smartphones and people being a lot more sort of tuned in to cybersecurity. So we're going to assume that doesn't really happen now, but we don't know. But we do know they're vicious, particularly the Murdoch press. Even though the News of the World shut down, it doesn't mean that Murdoch's foothold on Britain ended. I'd actually argue personally that it's stronger than ever today, constantly throwing out sensationalised news stories to the detriment of so many people. It is toxic, and the scariest thing to me isn't so much the journalism, it's the amount of people clinging on to their every word. You voted for Brexit? Chances are the tabloids got to you. You hate Prince Harry and Meghan Markle with a burning passion? They probably got you too. In February 2020, TV presenter Caroline Flack ended her own life after being hounded by the tabloid press, causing an emotional breakdown. MP Daisy Cooper said at the time, "In Britain we have trial by court and not trial by media for a reason. Regardless of what took place, she, Caroline, should not have been hounded to death by tabloid newspapers desperate for clickbait." The tabloid press, that need for clicks, for sensationalism, is one of the biggest problems in the UK right now, and it sends people down rabbit holes they just can't get out of. A lot of people love to argue that celebrities don't deserve privacy. This is what they choose when they put themselves in the public eye. The same comments that I see time and time again on the sort of comment section of tabloid posts on Facebook. But everyone deserves privacy. No one deserves to have their private moments listened to and then broadcast in the papers for everyone to see, no matter if you're a celebrity or not. It makes me think of the iCloud hackings that arrived just a few years back. Jennifer Lawrence vilified for her nudes being leaked. People hated her. For what? For somebody hacking into her private account and taking her personal photos without her permission? I'm pretty sure that's actually sexual assault nowadays. And then who can forget what the British tabloids did to Amy Winehouse, to Princess Diana, what they're doing now to Meghan Markle? If you feel different to me in regards to Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, I don't really want to know, I don't really care. Nothing Meghan has done has warranted how she's being treated currently by the British media. It is a witch hunt. If she were around in the early 2000s, I can guarantee her phone would have been hacked as well. Celebrity tabloid journalists are vultures, they will take whatever they can get. They said they'd change after the hacking scandal. They said they'd change after Princess Diana's death. They said they'd change after Caroline Flack's death. They haven't. And despite all of this, despite the hacking scandal, there is still nothing holding them accountable. There is nobody that is holding the tabloid press accountable for their actions, accountable for goading people into death a lot of the time. As I said at the beginning of this episode, news about this scandal is still coming out to this very day. It was recently revealed, as in literally like a number of weeks ago, that Rupert Murdoch secretly paid Prince William a very large sum of money back in 2020 to quietly settle the royal phone hacking claim dating all the way back to 2005. However, Prince Harry's legal battle with the company is still ongoing, with him submitting legal documents to the courts in which he claims there was a secret agreement struck between the royal family and executives at Murdoch's company at some point before 2012, in which the princes would delay legal proceedings in return for receiving an apology at a later date. Basically, the royal family didn't want any negative coverage. They didn't want members of the royal family to have to sit in a witness box and recount the sensitive and private details about their lives in regards to the hackings. However, when Prince Harry tried to seek this apology out in 2017, News UK failed to uphold its side of the agreement. They tried to arrange meetings, but they never went anywhere. As a result, Harry decided to launch legal proceedings against the publisher of The Sun and the News of the World, saying that they've targeted him for much of his life, hacking his voicemails and obtaining personal information. And most of these claims do relate back to the early 2000s. And although News UK have admitted phone hacking took place at the News of the World, it has always maintained that nothing of that nature took place at The Sun. Whether or not you believe that is up to you. So Prince William apparently received this private settlement, but Harry received nothing. And I suppose now with the release of his book Spare, his distancing from the royal family, he has nothing to lose anymore by going ahead with the legal proceedings his family didn't want him to go ahead with. And his lawyers have said that Harry is bringing the case because crime should not be allowed to pay. Prince Harry has seen the effect the media had on his mother, how it led to her death. The effect has had on him his entire life and now on his wife and one day, I'm sure, on his kids. If he wants to do this, I say good on him. Do it. Make the journalists pay. The phone hacking scandal eventually came out to the public after years of the News of the World trying to suppress this information, to pay people off, to give settlements. It makes me wonder what else was happening in this time. What other papers were complicit? What other techniques were being used to gain information? What things are happening at media companies now in 2023? I'm sure stuff is going to come out in the future. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I know this one was a little bit different. There was a lot of names, a lot of dates. I tried really hard with the script to keep it all like flowing. So hopefully I did a good job. Hopefully you found this interesting and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys.